Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 177 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
Hey, what's happening?
A little of this, a little of that.
Yeah.
You know how it goes.
Just a little of this, a little of that. That's what you got.
Just took my daughter back to college for her sophomore year.
Yeah.
So not quite as tough as taking her for her freshman year, but again, not easy. Being without her, so
get the ping ball table set up and all the cups and
what's a ping ball
or the ping pong
or table. Ping pong
or the ping pong.
I think in college you probably had a ping pong table, and that's something completely different.
And that's why I had the problems I have today.
No, dude, her apartment, you couldn't even put a ping pong table in it. It's so small.
It's micro, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty small. But no, everything's going well, and you know, you and I were talking on our Patreon video just about everything that's kind of going on here in the last week or so.
Crazy, man.
It's California wildfires and tropical storms and earthquakes and all of that on top of what we're dealing with Corona. It's brutal.
It really is, man.
But we send our well wishes out for anyone affected by those things. We haven't been outside of Corona, but we weren't affected by any of the other stuff so far. We continue to have some amazing Patreon support. Let's give some shout outs. We had Chelsea Swisher.
Hey, Swisher.
Vanessa.
What's going on, Vanessa?
Nicole Lightfoot.
Hey, well, she's a Lightfoot, not Heavyfoot.
I know.
You know, sneak around that way.
Ariane.
Hey, Ariane.
Dina.
What's going on, Dina?
Haley McGown.
Well, hey, Haley.
E.
What's up, E?
Randy Fasnot.
Hey, Fasnot.
Alyssa Hahn.
Hey, Alyssa.
Keith Ann Peterson.
Well, thanks, Keith Ann.
Mycroft.
What's going on, Mycroft?
April Fannin.
Thank you, April.
Jesse Mahey.
Hey, Mahey.
Jenny.
Good old Jenny.
John Oney.
Hey, John.
Rena Donald.
Well, thank you, Rena.
Lori Prusak.
Hey, Prusak.
Caitlin Bortz.
Hey, thank you, Caitlin.
Ashley Steele.
What's going on, Ashley?
Lema Lazdiata.
Lazadada.
That's probably closer than what I got.
Yeah.
Neil Anders.
Hey, thanks, Neil.
Missy Angel May.
Well, thanks, Missy.
Darla Dixon.
What's going on, Darla?
AJ.
Well, appreciate it, AJ.
And last but not least, Claire Michelle Lewis.
CML, thank you.
And then if we go back into the vault, Gibbs. This week we selected Kate.
Kate, you're the best.
Yep. So We appreciate all the new support, the continued support on Patreon. We had some great PayPal donations as well. We had Julie Shantz.
Or Shantz.
Shantz. Shannon McIntyre.
What's going on, McIntyre?
Michelle Holman.
Well, thank you, Michelle.
And Rosemary Overell.
Well, thank you, Rosemary.
So thank all of you. Gibbs, right now we have an episode out on True Crime All the Time.
Oh, man, that's good, too.
It's a good one. I really thought it was interesting. We're talking about the 1988 murder of Julie Love down in the Atlanta, Georgia area. This is an interesting case in that, I mean, first of all, it takes over a year for police to solve the case, and then they don't really solve it. It's only because one of the individuals involved comes forward.
Yeah, if it wasn't for that, we'd be talking about it on this podcast.
Yeah, we very well could, but there's a lot to it. I don't want to give anything away. I hope everyone checks it out. All right, buddy, are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
Oh, I sure am.
We are talking about the 1976 Bishop family murders that occurred in Bethesda, Maryland. It was on Tuesday, March 2nd, 1976, in Columbia, North Carolina, at around 1 p.m., that a local forestry agent named Ronald Brickhouse had been dispatched to investigate a brush fire inside the pine forest after another forestry agent up in a fire tower spotted smoke rising through this pine forest.
And you've been down in the Smokies. You've seen how they have those towers scattered about so they can catch those things.
Looking for forest fires.
Exactly.
Once on site of the fire, he saw a large pile of fresh dirt and then encountered two smoldering bodies, which turned out to be the cause of this brush fire. He quickly realized the bodies were two adult females. A little while later, he located three young boys underneath these two women. All of the bodies were in a shallow, uncovered gravesite. The grave was 6 feet long by 3 feet wide and 3 feet deep.
Not really big for five bodies.
No, doesn't seem like it. But it also doesn't seem as though whoever put the bodies there was doing it in a way that they were trying to completely conceal them.
Right.
If so, you would have put dirt over the bodies.
Exactly.
You know, then maybe some brush or whatever on top. But I think you mentioned it, not very big. So, you know, these bodies were, I guess, stuffed, for lack of a better word, kind of crammed into this gravesite. They had to be.
Thinking like a sardine.
To all fit.
Yeah.
As forestry firefighters came to the blazing 4-acre site to help put out and control this brush fire caused by the burning bodies, Ronald Brickhouse radioed for assistance from the Terrell County Sheriff, Royce Rhodes, and state medical examiner, Dr. Paige Hudson. On that same day, as the medical examiner unearthed the victims, Dr. Hudson told the local press that the victims appeared to have been bludgeoned to death before being set on fire in the forest. He further stated that one of the victims appeared to be in her mid-60s, while the other was somewhere most likely in her 30s. The three boys were between the ages of 6 and 15. He had the body sent to his medical office for a detailed examination. The county sheriff was quick to point out he did not believe that these victims were local. You know, this was a small county, just slightly over 4,000 people. Investigators told the press that day that the assailant or assailants apparently tried to obscure the matter by burning the body. They also said that the boys were all in their pajamas and the younger woman was wearing dungarees and a dungaree jacket. The eldest woman wore an overcoat with a fur collar, and all five of the bodies had been soaked in gasoline.
Horrific.
I think horrific in any county, but when you look at, you know, this county, 4,000 people, my assumption is they're not used to finding five burned bodies in a shallow grave.
No, probably not even used to finding five dead bodies, period.
No, at any time.
Let alone together and potentially, you know, all from the same family.
The next day, it was reported that investigators felt all five victims were related. The sheriff asked for assistance from the State Bureau of Investigations, or SBI. Investigators knew that the three children and the younger adult female all had suffered several blows to their heads. The medical examiner at that point had not determined the cause of death in the older adult female. Investigators had no missing person reports to go from, and they didn't receive any calls, Gibbs, from the public after this case was kind of publicized in the media.
So, I mean, right there, probably told them it couldn't have been somebody local.
Anybody in the surrounding area where five people of one family had gone missing, I think that's going to be realized and communicated to the authorities pretty quickly.
Yeah, I would think so. It should be a red flag.
The SBI and the Sheriff's Department were out on site that entire day. They were combing the site for clues, and they did find a few things. They discovered the gas can that was likely used, a pitchfork, and a shovel that was most likely used to dig the shallow grave. It was noted that these items all appeared to be fairly new. I mean, the pitchfork still had part of the store label on it, and police were able to determine that it read Pox Hardware. And pretty quickly, authorities were able to figure out that Pox Hardware was located in Bethesda, Maryland. They also somehow figured out that the older adult female's coat had come from Bethesda, Maryland as well.
I know it had a fur collar on it. Maybe it was like a specialty coat.
Maybe, but it's pretty good police work. I mean, it's pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they're doing this all in kind of the same day that, exactly, you know, everything's being discovered. So they called authorities in Bethesda, Maryland, but authorities there had no reports of a missing family. So these agencies continued to work every angle possible. They were trying to develop any leads they could on these very horrific murders, but it was a huge mystery. I mean, the locals were mystified. Who are these five victims that appeared to not be local? Did they come from Maryland?
I mean, you know, this had to be pretty big conversation at all the local coffee shops, restaurants.
When you say all of them, how many could there be?
Well, one or two.
In a town
one
or two, yeah. 4,000 people.
Yeah, that had to be the subject that everybody was talking about.
Yeah, I would agree with you. But it wouldn't be all that long before authorities would get the break that they needed. On Wednesday, March 10th, in Bethesda, Maryland, an individual had some concerns about her neighbors who lived next door on Lilystone Drive in the upscale Carter Rock Springs historical neighborhood. She hadn't seen the family in about 2 weeks or so. She made several attempts to make contact, but she couldn't get anyone to answer the door, so she called police. She told the dispatcher she was worried about her neighbors, the Bishops. A local police detective was sent to do a welfare check. The neighbor had a key, but it was only for emergencies. But I guess they considered this an emergency, Gibbs. They gave it to the detective to use to gain entry. Now, my question is, would you do that if you're the neighbor?
Oh, I probably would have. If I thought something was wrong, I might have went ahead and used the key before I called.
I get that. I think for me, I'm not sure if I would ever know for sure or think something's wrong.
Yeah.
I just don't pay enough attention to my neighbors and I don't know them well enough. I would never have a neighbor come to me and say, hey, you know, we're getting ready to go on a 2-week trip. Can you get my mail?
Right.
I don't have that relationship with any of my neighbors, so I'm not sure I would know.
And you wouldn't want that responsibility anyway.
No, and I wouldn't accept it.
Right. But I think in today's world, I think if someone's going to have you watch their house, you're probably close enough that you have their cell phones.
Yes.
You know, and emails and things like that.
We're definitely in a different age as far as technology goes. I was just kind of thinking, I'm not sure if I would know that my neighbors have been gone for 2 weeks or there's not been that much activity.
Right.
Unlike you, I don't get up every morning, get in my car and leave and then come back at 5:36, whatever time.
Yeah, there's
I'm in this studio pretty much all day.
There's days you don't see the sun.
No,
at all.
It's a very vampirish lifestyle, if that's how you say it.
I've actually been concerned about your, you know,
skin color.
Yeah.
Hey,
just saying.
What are you gonna do, man?
Yeah.
My dermatologist says it's good for me.
Is that I bet.
So this detective made his way to the front door and I mean, right away, he noticed some drops of blood on the front stoop. As he entered the house, he saw blood spatter on the foyer floor. And then with every step forward, the detective noticed even more blood spatter. It was on the steps, the walls, on the floors. But what the detective saw next was beyond disturbing. When he stepped into one of the children's rooms, there was blood spatter everywhere the eye could see. It was on the walls. Gibbs, it was on the ceiling, the floor. The beds were completely covered in blood. So right away, the detective called out the forensics team to the house to investigate what happened inside that house. And it was that day that investigators were able to link the missing Bishop family to the bodies discovered in Columbia, North Carolina the week before. And they did it by using dental records to identify the bodies. The oldest adult female was identified as 68-year-old Lobelia Bishop. The other adult female was identified as 37-year-old Annette Bishop. The three children were identified as Annette's children, 14-year-old William, 10-year-old Brenton, and 4-year-old Jeffrey. What the investigators didn't know was where the father of this family was and what had happened to him. They also couldn't figure out what happened to the family dog.
Yeah, it was a golden retriever named Leo. And those are always good dogs.
Yeah, really hard to beat a golden retriever. Now, I'm not crazy about the shedding.
No.
Same with my black lab. My black lab is great. He's a great dog.
Right.
But man, he sheds.
Well, those goldens shed a little bit more, I think.
Yeah, they shed a lot.
Yeah.
Now, they identified the father early on as William Bradford Bishop. They found his bloody fingerprints inside the home. Bishop worked for the State Department in Washington, D.C. And I think it was after this, Gibbs, that the FBI was brought in to assist with the investigation.
And it makes sense. You have the murder taking place in one location, then whatever happened down in North Carolina with the burial, fire, and the fact that he works for the government. There's a lot of different angles there that they should be involved.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. By the end of the day on March 10th, the Montgomery County Sheriff, the FBI, and other investigators determined that the five victims were murdered inside the house and then transported to North Carolina. And I think, Gibbs, they immediately started to focus in on Bradford Bishop. If you look at the victims, 68-year-old Lobelia was his mother. 37-year-old Annette was his wife.
Right.
And then, of course, all three children were his. They haven't heard from him. There's no sign of him.
No.
He's got to be suspect number one.
They've got his fingerprints inside the home.
Well, not just that, but they were bloody. And I think there's a distinction there, right? It's his home.
Right.
You're going to find tons of his fingerprints. But when you find a bloody fingerprint,
tells you he was there at the time of the murders.
That definitely tells you something, for sure. I think one of the problems they had was they couldn't find any ties for him in the state of North Carolina. They interviewed his employer. They interviewed coworkers. and found out that Bishop had been highly stressed for weeks. They learned that he was last seen at the office on March 1st. As the news about the mass murder of the five members of the Bishop family hit the press and was broadcast over the news, the investigators started to receive some leads.
This had to be a pretty big story, I would have thought, back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you have the murder of five family members,
right,
and the husband is missing, that's going to be a big story.
Yeah, I know from the articles that we researched, we saw a ton, but you would think that back then the three networks probably ran this story, being close to DC.
Sure.
The fact that, you know, you have the intrigue between the murders happening here, but they were buried down there. It plays into a pretty big mystery.
Well, I think you add in the fact that he works for the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been picked up.
Oh, absolutely.
Investigators determined that on March 1st, Bishop arrived at his office that morning, but shortly after he got there, he found out that he didn't get this promotion that he had been hoping for.
We've all been there.
We've all been there. It's not a good feeling. So he told the office secretary that he didn't feel well and he was going home for the day. Okay, I get it. You're disappointed. Something you really been looking forward to. I can't take it. I can't be here today.
Right.
I can't look at all these people.
I don't want to see that guy over there gloating because he did get the job.
Well, and let's face it, you and I have been in this type of environment. I'm not saying the State Department.
Right.
But this type of environment where people are up for promotion a lot of times, it's not like people don't know you didn't get it.
Exactly.
It's not a secret. So
yeah.
To walk around that office, well, you're basically interacting with a bunch of people that they're going to be saying, oh, sorry, man.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to go through all that.
Right. Really should have been you, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Behind your back, they're saying, I'm glad that SOB didn't get it.
Exactly.
I mean, about you, not me.
Well,
they would have never said that about
never.
Me. But here's what investigators have said about the time after Bishop left the office. They said he went to his bank, withdrew several hundred dollars. He then made a stop at the Montgomery Mall, which was located next to his bank. Inside the mall, he purchased a ball peen hammer and a gas can from the Sears store. Bishop then stopped at the gas station to fill up his rust-colored Chevrolet station wagon.
That's a beautiful color on a car.
Yeah, I like rust.
Yeah.
He also filled up this new gas can that he bought. And then after that, he stopped at the Pox hardware store near his house and he bought a pitchfork and shovel. All right, not looking real good here based on the things that we already know.
Yeah, not good at all.
Investigators were able to place Bishop back at his house sometime between 7:30 and 8:30 p.m. Like we mentioned, they had his bloody fingerprints in the house. And right. It wasn't just one location. There were a bunch of different locations where they found his bloody fingerprints.
Right.
So I think this is a good time to take a step back, Gibbs, and give a little bit of background information on William Bradford Bishop.
Because he does have an interesting background.
And, you know, he's kind of the main player, for the lack of a better term, in this case.
Exactly.
William Bradford Bishop Jr. was born August 1st, 1936, in Pasadena, California. He graduated from South Pasadena High School and in 1959 received a Bachelor's of Science degree in history from Yale University. All right. Already impressive.
Yeah.
Not an easy school to get into. That's a very valuable degree.
Took me
a year and a half, didn't it, to get yours?
Exactly.
But then he went on to get a Master of Arts degree in International Studies from Middlebury College and a second master's degree in African Studies from UCLA.
Again, not easy to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think from this, you can tell. There's no doubt Bishop was an intelligent person. You don't rack up all those degrees, you don't even try to get all of those,
right?
Unless you have some type of thirst for knowledge and, you know, you're into academics and you want to study and you want to put in that work and you're somewhat highly intelligent.
Exactly. Got to have that love for academia.
As we know you do. It was during the time that he was getting his master's degree that he married Annette. Then he served 4 years in the Army performing counterintelligence.
That's impressive as well.
I mean, we're getting into a very Gibby-like area. I mean, this is a guy who could speak more than a half dozen languages. He specialized in Italian, French, Serbian, and Spanish.
Really close to what I can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bishop eventually joined the U.S. State Department and served in the U.S. Foreign Service in several roles overseas. He was stationed in several Italian cities, Verona, Milan, Florence. Not bad places to be.
No,
I'd like to be. If you got to be sent overseas,
send me to Florence so I can hang out with the Florence foodies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He later served as a foreign service officer in a number of African countries. Then he was promoted as an assistant chief in the Division of Special Activities and Commercial Treaties at the State Department headquarters in Washington. So this is a guy who spent a lot of time acquiring knowledge.
Exactly.
Racking up degrees, yep. Got married, served time in the military, and then spent a number of years overseas. You would think just by looking at that trajectory that, man, things are really going well.
Yeah, he's on a good path.
Yeah, an upward trajectory for sure.
Yeah. But we also know what looks good on the outside is not always what looks good on the inside.
Yeah, that's a new one, Gibbs. I don't know if I've ever heard that one. Are you trying to say that things aren't always what they appear?
Exactly.
All right. I got
you. Yeah.
But now he's got this big promotion, right? So, you know, add that on top of everything else. Bishop was an avid outdoorsman. He enjoyed camping, hiking. At one point, he got his pilot's license.
You've always wanted to do that, didn't you?
I actually have wanted to do that. What I can't figure out is where this guy got the time to do everything that he did. Maybe he just wasn't lazy.
Yeah, I think he was pretty proactive in a lot of stuff.
He had to have been to get all of this stuff done.
Like, I want to learn more stuff, but like when I go to open the book or go to start the course.
The book on tape?
Yeah.
You want it to happen through osmosis. You literally just want it to like be pushed inside your head. You don't want to have to do anything to acquire
it. You just want to take that pill and you swallow it and you're like,
exactly.
You're like Bradley Cooper, man. And all of a sudden you're like, have all this knowledge in that movie he did.
But he also enjoyed riding motorcycles. He worked out quite a bit. But here's the thing about Bishop. He did have a history of depression and he took a drug for that. It was called Xarax, but he stopped taking it just a few weeks before the murder of his family.
Which if a doctor prescribes that to you, there's normally a good reason why you should continue to take it, right?
Yeah, and I think especially with drugs like that are for depression, anxiety, some of those drugs, from my understanding, they're not ones that you just want to stop taking cold turkey.
Yeah.
I think doctors will say,
cycle.
We got to wean you off of some of these things because there can be some nasty side effects. Yeah. But again, as we're going through this, some of the pieces of the puzzle are starting to fall into place. So we talked about it, Gibbs. Investigators were able to place Bishop at his house sometime between 7:30 and 8:30 p.m. on March 1st. Investigators theorized that once Bishop got home, he found his wife, Annette, reading. He struck her several times in the head with the ball peen hammer, killing her. And I think part of this, Gibbs, is they found a book at the location where her bloodstains were found. I mean, that's part of the theory that she was reading this book. Investigators believe that after he killed his wife, Bishop went up to the children's bedrooms and he first struck his oldest son in the head several times. He followed that by striking his other two boys until all three were dead.
And I guess that makes sense. I hate to say that, you know, he went after the oldest first because the oldest would probably could give him a some type of fight.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a horrible tragedy.
Right.
Taking nothing away from that, if you're just looking at it from a, what's the word, a clinical perspective.
Tactical.
Or a, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You see that a lot with all killers.
Right.
For the most part, they're going to target the person that is the biggest threat to them first.
Yeah.
Try to take that person out, eliminate that threat, and then move on.
Yeah.
Again, it's hard to say it in such a cold way, but if you're looking at it from that viewpoint, it makes absolute sense that he would have done it that way. And then at some point, his mother returned to the house with the dog. She must have been out walking Leo, the golden retriever. When she walked in the door, Bishop struck her with a fireplace iron. It didn't kill her.
No, it just bruised her forehead.
The problem is she went into cardiac arrest and died. This is what authorities believe happened. Then later that night, he loaded his mother, his wife, and his three boys into the family station wagon. Investigators theorized that Bishop left in the middle of the night and didn't make a stop on the trip from Bethesda, Maryland to Columbia, North Carolina.
That's like a 275-mile trip.
Which is shocking to me from the standpoint that in the 1970s, I can't imagine a station wagon got more than, what, 10 miles to the gallon?
You think, because I think that station wagon had a 22-gallon tank.
So now I'm wondering, how did he make that? Unless he used some of the gas from the gas can.
Could have.
And maybe the station wagon got a little bit more than what I'm thinking it would have.
Right.
I just know big cars in the 70s like that, they got horrible gas mileage.
I don't think they even had unleaded back then, did they? Wouldn't we just running regular gasoline back then? I think.
I don't know, right. Dude. I was 3 years old.
Well,
you had been driving for 10 years.
Whatever.
So you should know these things.
I was 10 at that time, though.
And probably driving.
Well, if I had to, whatever I had to, you know, keep the farm running.
But to me, that was a question that I had while we were doing the research. I just couldn't figure out the answer. Maybe I guess we could have looked up the average
miles per gallon.
But
hey, it was all highway. All
on
highway.
That station wagon. Yeah, so that's going to be a little bit better. And to be honest with you, I don't know how authorities would have made that conclusion. Because he could have stopped at a filling station. He could have paid cash.
Exactly.
There would have been no record of it.
No.
So, but they believe he arrived at the site in North Carolina in the forest early on the morning of March 2nd. He then dug the shallow grave using the shovel and the pitchfork that he bought the previous day. He placed the three boys at the bottom of the gravesite. Then he laid his wife and mother on top of the children. And Gibbs, that's when he poured the gasoline on the bodies and around the gravesite and ignited it.
How sick of an individual do you have to be, first, to pre-plan, right? I mean, he stopped off the hardware store, bought the gas can, the hammer, the fork, the pitchfork, right?
This was no spur of the moment thing.
No. You know, he goes home. He knows exactly what he's going to do.
And in what order he's going
to
do it.
Yeah. And not only to his kids and his wife, but his own mom, right? So the closest people in his whole world, he kills. Then he says, let me throw them in my wagon. I'm going to drive with them in my car for 5 hours or whatever it takes. What are you even thinking in the car as you're driving with your family dead a couple rows back?
That I'm going to find an out-of-the-way spot, I'm going to dig a grave,
yeah.
And then I'm going to
burn them.
These people that I'm supposed to take care of, I'm supposed to love, I've already killed them, now I'm going to burn them.
I'm going to burn them.
But again, you and I ask this question all the time. And I think it's the question that people that are into true crime continue to ask, continue to speculate, and really, you know, look at as they go through these cases, what is going on in this guy's mind?
Yeah.
That A is allowing him to do this, or is, you know, pushing him forward to do this. And then I think B, just how is someone able to do that to the people that they care about or are supposed to care about?
It sounds like a study that John Douglas should have had the opportunity to perform, you know, the Mindhunter action there.
Yeah, you know, we don't always know the answers. I think the one thing that I know for sure is that some of these people's minds, they don't work the way that, or at least they're not working at the time, the way that the rest of ours is.
Right.
Because most people just can't even fathom how they could make that decision or come to that decision that this is what I need to do.
Yeah, especially when they make it just seems like that, boom, snap, you know, they make that decision that quick. They don't weigh on it. They don't go back and forth. I don't know. I'm going to go over to Fergie's today, walk down his basement, hit him in the head with a hammer, and walk back out.
Now, we've already talked about what investigators found at the scene in North Carolina. They found the shovel, they found the pitchfork, and they found the gas can. So they believed that Bishop left all that stuff behind, thinking that it would all burn up in the blaze that he created.
Yeah.
But it didn't.
No.
So after he did all this, he got back into his station wagon and he drove away. Investigators figured out that someone used his bank card about 100 miles away from the gravesite that afternoon in Jacksonville, North Carolina. When investigators went to the store, they talked to the clerk at the sporting goods store, and the clerk said that a man fitting Bishop's description bought a pair of tennis shoes, and from what he could tell, he had a golden retriever in his vehicle and what appeared to be a dark-skinned woman in the passenger seat.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Well, we know they didn't find the dog.
Right.
So a lot of people probably put it together that maybe the dog was with him. Now it's kind of confirmed by the store employee. I don't think that's a big bombshell. What is a big bombshell to me is who is this woman?
Right.
In the passenger seat of his car, was she the cause for all of this, as is sometimes the case?
Yeah, what role did she play in it?
What role did she play? And did she come from Maryland and make this drive with him to North Carolina with these five bodies in the car? Or was she somehow waiting in North Carolina and he picked her up there, and that's why he chose the site that he did?
Or is he smart enough to pick up a hitchhiker
to give himself some cover? Yeah.
And she's sitting in the car waiting on him because he said, hey, I just got to run in and get a pair of shoes. I'll be right back. Stay here with my dog.
Watch my dog. That's actually really smart. Maybe she has nothing to do with any of this.
Right.
And we mentioned it. This is an intelligent guy.
Because why would he use his bank card knowing that it most likely would have been traced to that location eventually?
Mm-hmm. Unless he wanted it to be.
Exactly.
And he wanted the investigators to come question this guy. Yeah, man, you are smart.
It throws
much smarter than I normally give you credit for.
Well, I am a member of the club.
The club. But I think it's, again, just part of what makes this such a mystery in some senses. It's not a mystery as to kind of what happened and who did it.
Right.
But the reasons why and some of the things that happen are a little mysterious.
Sure.
And the reason why we don't have all the answers is because technically it's an unsolved case.
He's very good at evading the police.
Well, he has been for sure.
Yeah.
On March 18th, the Bishop's 1974 rust color Chevrolet station wagon was reported abandoned in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park at a campground in Elkmont, Tennessee, by a park employee there. They said it had been parked at the site since March 5th, from what they could recall. Now, this location was about 400 miles west of the gravesite in North Carolina. When investigators checked out the car, they found a very bloody blanket in the back, along with an axe and a shotgun. In the front seat, they found some dog biscuits and a shaving kit. Inside the shaving kit was medication that belonged to William Bradford Bishop. So, of course, they're going to take this car back to the lab. They're going to, you know, tear it apart for clues. When they opened the spare tire compartment in the back, they found a puddle of blood sitting inside that compartment.
Not too shocking, right? Knowing that he put all five bloody bodies back there for the entire drive.
Yeah, that blood's going to pool somewhere.
Right.
And it's going to pool at the lowest point, which makes sense that the lowest point in that car would be the compartment where the spare tire was located. So I think one of the questions I have, Gibbs, is, okay, he's abandoned his car.
Right.
I get the reason why you would do that. Police would be on the lookout for that car. The question is, why abandon it there?
Yeah.
And did he get another car, or, you know, the Smoky Mountains is kind of a good place to get lost.
Well, we know he was adventurous, in good shape,
enjoyed the outdoors. Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that's the angle that investigators kind of went with, right? They believe that he abandoned his car. He attempted to kind of escape along the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah.
Either by himself or with this woman or others. They brought in canine units to track his scent, but they didn't get any hits, had no luck. He basically disappeared.
So did he go up into the trail? Because the trail runs from, you can go all the way down to, you know, Georgia, all the way up to New England states. Or is this another one of his tricks? Let me park my car here, like you said, go somewhere else. But now police are like, he's got to be here.
Right.
Got to be up in those trails. Let's go find him. Meanwhile, he's
driven off. He's in another state.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell. I mean, there are places, you know, along that trail, you could get lost. Nobody's going to find you.
No. I thought about hiking that trail one of these days.
I have not. That does not seem appealing to me at all.
Sounds fun. Not
10
by
minutes.
Myself.
I'll go with you for 10 minutes.
You wouldn't be able to get to the beginning of the trail in 10 minutes.
And then I'm done. Now, the very next day, March 19th, a grand jury indicted Bishop on 5 counts of first-degree murder and a whole slew of other charges. Authorities felt that the motive could have been a couple of different things. They found out that the Bishops had some marital problems. Annette was not happy that Bradford traveled as much as he did for his job. I think he enjoyed that.
Oh, I think he did too.
You know, it was said that he wanted to continue to travel the world and take other assignments. Annette didn't want that. She wanted him to stay put, stay home. Let's put down some roots. Let's be a normal, typical family.
Right.
Well, pretty hard when you're gallivanting all around the world to, you know, be a real dad. You're not home if you're never home.
And you got to think about where their kids' ages were.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to move around a lot at that age. You know, your kids are, 14, and the younger ones there. You want to be stable.
Yes.
Let them get used to the school, their friends.
Oh, I get you. You're saying if they're all moving
at
the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah. There were some reports that the family was experiencing some financial trouble, that they might have been getting audited by the IRS.
That's never good.
No, that's stress-inducing for sure. And whatever the cause of it, I think investigators kind of thought it was stress-related, right? That Bradford Bishop was under a lot of stress. He wasn't happy with his life. He wasn't happy being this dad, this family man. And when he didn't get the promotion, which would have allowed him to travel more, that probably sent him over the edge. especially if he was not taking his medication as prescribed, which is what authorities thought had happened.
That would do it right there.
The FBI and other investigators know that Bishop got about an 8-day jump on them. And because of his job, he very easily could have fled the United States before they even had a bead on him.
Yeah.
And it's thought that authorities would have had a very hard time tracking him.
Well, he did have a diplomatic passport, so.
And with that, you know, it was said, Gibbs, in the reporting that would have made it much easier for him to get in and out of countries without leaving a record of his entry and exit. So without that, kind of hard to track somebody.
It really is. He also had several acquaintances overseas too.
Yeah. I mean, over the years, I'm sure he made friends and
connections
in a lot of different countries. Over the years, the FBI and the United States Marshal Service have had some tips on sightings of Bishop in Italy, Greece, Spain, England, the Netherlands, and several other countries. Now, some of these sightings have been a little more reliable than others. In July of 1978, a friend of the Bishop family spotted him in Stockholm, Sweden, allegedly.
Yeah.
At least thought that they spotted him.
Or his doppelganger.
Then in January 1979, one of Bishop's previous co-workers said that they saw him in Sorrento, Italy, coming out of a public bathroom. They called out to him, but he ran off.
I find that a little strange.
That somebody would run off when you call to them?
Yeah, well, and you also would spot him, like, of all places. Hey, that looks like Fergie coming out of that bathroom.
Hey.
Being so far away, I don't know, it'd be weird, but...
I use the bathroom just like everybody else.
I will say, one time I was in the Mexican Riviera, and I was coming out of some weird place. I can't remember what it was.
It's hard telling with you.
Yeah. But all of a sudden I hear this, Mike? Mike? And I turned around, it was my brother's ex-girlfriend, and she was down there, and somehow she recognized me. And it's been like 8-9 years, right, mm-hmm. since I saw her last.
Stalker.
Yeah. And I was like, hey. You know, but so I guess it could happen.
Yeah, it could definitely happen. But also, you know, we've talked about this before. People think they see people.
Right.
Is it them? Maybe. Or do they just somewhat look like them and your mind kind of goes there?
Yeah. And maybe the guy ran because he said, why is this guy yelling at me? I just came out of the bathroom.
I didn't wash my hands. I didn't want him to know me.
Exactly.
To know that. In September of 1994, this is almost 20 years after the murders, another friend of the Bishop family thought that they saw Bradford on a train platform in Switzerland. So again, you know, how reliable are these sightings? We don't know. Other theories have come out over the years that he's in the States, California, Washington State. Some have come out that he could have defected to the Soviet Union.
Well, back then, maybe.
Wouldn't be my first choice.
No. They would have gave him up by now then anyway.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that information would have come out probably.
Yeah.
There are other theories that he did hike up into the Smoky Mountains and took his own life.
Well, I guess you could do that and never be found.
You could. I mean, if you were in a very remote area, and you're talking about animals, scavengers, your bones get scattered, not to be macabre about it, but it could happen where you would never be found.
Yeah, for sure.
Over the years, the FBI have had reports of Bishop being found dead. In 2001, it was reported that he died in Hong Kong. And the same year, it was reported he died in Paris, France. Now, I think they cleared those up pretty quickly with fingerprint analysis, right? If you have a deceased body, not too hard.
Right.
And you have his fingerprints, not too hard to match them. In 2014, the FBI exhumed a John Doe based on reports that the John Doe resembled Bradford Bishop. The John Doe had been killed in a hit and run in Alabama in 1981. But they were able to confirm through DNA that the man was not Bradford Bishop. So, I mean, if you think about it, Gibbs, I mean, they have really tried to find this guy. It's not like they just said, oh, you know, he got away.
No, they definitely had the efforts out there.
Well, and the FBI tends to do that.
Yeah.
they're pretty thorough with things. And, you know, to that point, Bishop made the FBI's top 10 most wanted list in 2014. He stayed on it for a few years. That got some additional exposure, but it didn't help them find him.
It didn't.
William Bradford Bishop Jr., a man wanted for murdering his wife, three sons, and his mother, is the latest addition to the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives list.
To be able to take a hammer to your children's heads and faces while they're sleeping, I think, really exhibits the brutality of the crime.
I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau with Wanted by the FBI. Bishop, a former U.S. State Department employee, killed his family on March 1st, 1976, the same day he learned he had been passed over for a promotion. Bishop, an insomniac, had been under psychiatric care for depression. Case agent Charles Adams says Bishop then drove to North Carolina where he
dug a hole, a shallow grave, and laid the bodies in that shallow grave and then proceeded to set them on fire.
The next day, Bishop was seen buying tennis shoes with a woman his age and what may have been the family dog. His car was found at the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and inside were maps and hiking information.
He was an avid outdoorsman. Not only that, he had an aptitude for learning languages, Spanish, Serbo-Croatian, French, Italian.
Bishop is also a pilot. A $100,000 reward is being offered for information leading to Bishop's arrest. Report tips to 1-800-CALL-FBI or visit FBI.gov.
So I think that's interesting, Gibbs. That was made, you know, at the time that he made the 10 most wanted list.
Right.
Not a lot of additional information there, but kind of interesting to hear from some of the case agents and, you know, some of the people that worked it.
And he was also featured on some other crime shows like Unsolved Mysteries, The Hunt, America's Most Wanted, and a few others.
I actually think the first time I ever heard of the case of Bradford Bishop was on America's Most Wanted. It was either there or Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah.
But I kind of remember John Walsh covering the case. So I think that's probably where I saw it first back in the day. So as we wrap up this case, I mean, I don't want to dwell on it too much. It's horrible. I mean, I think everybody listening would agree with that, that a father would kill not only his mother, mm-hmm. not only his wife, but then his three children.
Yeah.
I think, like you said, what kind of man can do that?
Not only that he killed them, but how he killed them, by taking a hammer and beating their skulls in.
So here's one thing that's troubled me during as we were researching the case and as we were, you know, kind of going through it. What was the purpose of taking the bodies to North Carolina, digging the grave, putting them in the grave, and burning the bodies? If you were going to go on the run, why not just leave the bodies in the house? It wasn't like the authorities weren't going to think you were responsible. You're the only one who doesn't show up.
Right.
Am I missing something?
Well, maybe it was part of his master plan that by taking them to North Carolina, it bought him that extra time, that extra week to get away. You know, part of his plan maybe it was to park the car at the Smoky Mountains. Besides trying to make them think he's somewhere where he's not. I don't know why else he would do that.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about how smart this guy was. So obviously he had a plan or he had a reason for doing this. I'm just really struggling with figuring out what it was or what it accomplished.
Or is the fact that he wanted to be with this, whoever this woman that was in his car, maybe it was not a hitchhiker. Maybe it really was somebody he wanted to be with. She lived in that area. He killed his family, transported the bodies down there, disposed of them, went and picked her up, and started his new life.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I just don't know why he had to do it because, you know, okay, let's say your theory's correct. He still could have just driven to North Carolina without the bodies.
Yeah.
I don't see how it bought him more time. I don't see how it really accomplished anything. He must have thought it was going to. I just can't figure out what he thought it was going to help him do or what it was going to accomplish. Unless he thought that by burning the bodies, there would be no way to identify them. But he had to have been smarter than that. It's very hard to completely burn bodies.
Well, I think he was trying to buy himself more time, give himself a buffer. Because if that fire would have done its job that he wanted it to do, it would have burned up the shovel, the pitchfork. It would have burned up the clothes that they had on. And at that point, the authorities there would never have known to reach out up to Maryland.
Or at least not as quickly as they did, because they figured it out very quickly.
Right.
The day that the bodies were found, they made the connection to Maryland.
Yeah.
I think you're right on the money. Eventually, they would have identified those bodies.
Yeah.
But without the connection to Maryland to know to get the dental records from that area, I think in the 1970s, it would have taken a lot longer.
Right.
I'm thinking. So, okay, that does make sense.
Intriguing all the way around.
It is, and I think the time frame, right? When you think back to the 70s, much easier to disappear, especially for a guy who had the training and the access that Bishop had.
Yeah.
Now, in 2020, post 9/11, what it takes to fly, could he do something? Maybe with his connections, he could.
I think it'd be tough, man.
I just think much tougher today to do some of these things and get away with it. But the other thing we got to talk about is if he didn't die,
yeah,
he could still be alive today.
Sure.
Which means if he is, even as technology has increased, he's been able to stay off the grid.
Yeah. Like a Whitey Bulger. Eventually they catch up with you.
Yeah, I was going to say, they did eventually catch up with him.
Yeah.
And if he's still alive, maybe they'll catch up with Bradford Bishop. So that's it for the Bishop family murders. Whether you want to call them unsolved or just unresolved. I mean, technically, they charged him. But until he's convicted, you have to call it unsolved.
Yeah.
Even though every single thing points to the fact that he murdered his family, burned their bodies, and then took off. We got some voicemails. You want to check those out?
Yeah, let's hear them.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. It's Sarah here from Nashville. Typically, I don't really listen to the unsolved stuff because I'm so far behind on regular TCAT. However, I just listened to the Pasco County 4 case, and I was just amazed because I am from Pasco County, Florida. I grew up there, actually worked for the sheriff's office there, and I loved hearing something that I knew exactly where everything was and everything. And I'm telling you, anytime you see a Florida man, chances are he's been from Pasco County. It is just a cornucopia of true crime cases, all the way from certain events from the Donnie Brasco movie to porn star murders to neo-Nazis. Take a look. You would definitely find a bunch of stuff to report on. Also, if you want to look into a case that actually took 25 years, it was a 25-year-old cold case at Pasco Sheriff's Office that was solved by one of the detectives there, and, her husband did it. But it took 25 years to have her body identified, and, the cold case was actually solved, and it was really interesting. Her name is Amy Hurst. So I love your podcast. I love that I'm getting back into it now that I'm driving back and forth to work. And as always, keep your own time. Bye, guys.
Well, thanks, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you very much. We'll definitely check out that case. I think she hit on something there at the end. You know, with the pandemic and with so many people staying home, yeah, there are a lot of new people that have found the podcast because they needed something to do.
Right.
Some of the regular listeners, I think, are not listening as much because their normal routine is to either listen on their drive or listen, while they're at work. So I think there's some people that are going to have some catching up to do.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Get back to that regular commute one of these days.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. This is Caitlin. I'm calling from Gothenburg, Sweden. I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia. So I was really, really stoked here that you guys had a huge following in Sweden. Granted, I'm only on like episode 66, so I have some time to catch up, but I'm really, really enjoying it. And I love the banter back and forth. And I think that Gibby is so funny with some of the jokes he says back at Mike and then Mike back to Gibby. I think that it's all fun comic relief, especially when talking about super, super dark subjects. It kind of helps get the listeners through. So thank you so much for everything that you guys do. I will keep listening, and thank you so much, and keep your own time ticking.
Why you not have a Sweden accent yet?
So I was, you know, when I first heard it, I was like, man, she has the best English American accent that I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Somebody from Sweden. Well, come to find out she's from
Georgia.
Georgia, so.
Hey guys, I just got my Patreon shout out and I am so impressed, Fergie. You got my name right. Nobody ever says my name right. This is Kim Grateful, by the way. I'm just glad your daughter is doing well and I'm sending good thoughts and good vibes your way. And I can't wait to hear from you again next week. Love you guys. Bye.
See, there you go.
Well, I have to get some of them right.
Yeah. Odds.
I can't get everyone wrong.
the odds are, you know.
I don't know if they're in my favor, but...
Well, they're there.
They can't be zero.
Yeah, good day, old mate. Mate, love your show. Keeps him occupied on the road. Just two things. Canawindra is pronounced Canawindra, and that other one in Western Australia that I can't even pronounce the way you pronounced it is Kununurra. But yeah, no, you're all good. Take care, keep your own time kicking, and keep the song inside up. Cheers, mate. Bye.
Appreciate it, mate.
That actually wasn't too bad. So... I'm not sure what episode it was, what Australian episode it was, but I'm not exactly sure what he said as far as the...
Just say thank you.
The city names.
So thank you.
Well, no, because I want to know.
No, I...
Canna something something.
Thank you. Is that the one where we talked about the Subarus?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got you. All right. I'll go back and listen to it because I really want to... Now, chances are, will I ever have to say it again?
I doubt it,
but if I do, I really hate to get it wrong again when somebody's telling me how to say it right.
I'll say it next time. You don't have to worry about it. Okay. I'll use my Australian accent.
Well, then that'll make it right for sure.
Absolutely.
All right, everyone. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.